So we use a lot of rehabilitative exercise because we find that's the best way to find what people can do and start there, encourage them through and give them hope, improve some capacity in some part of their life. Being in rehab is a little bit social. We use manual therapy and we don't use it as I'm going to fix this misalignment or I'm going to stretch this muscle or I'm going to beat this fascia into submission or whatever. I don't think any of that's actually a real outcome of most manual therapy, to be honest with you. But it's a great opportunity to kind of engage the patient in focusing on their tissues and what their tissues are doing, the tissue consistency, what movement is lacking, what movement could be improved. It helps steer them into, okay, we're going to use rehab to work on this area that's not working or moving as well as it should.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Wellness, a podcast sponsored by the Columbia Association. I'm Dr. Harry Okun, a community physician for over 35 years and the medical director of the Columbia Association. I am proud to be working with Columbia Association for over a decade to help assist in their mission to improve the health and wellness of our community. Today, you're going to meet my guest, Dr. Brian Morrison, and we'll be talking about chronic pain and how to live with it. Brian is a long-term member of the Columbia Association's Medical Advisory Board. He's a graduate of the Logan College of Chiropractic Medicine and has been in private practice in Ellicott City since 1998. He's also the past director of the Chiropractic Services at the University of Maryland School of Medicine for Integrative Health and Healing. He presently is still on the teaching faculty at the university, and he lectures about various topics such as manual therapy, pain science, and work-related musculoskeletal disorders. So today, we are going to talk about the integrative approach to pain. Chronic pain is a significant issue in this country, and it's defined as chronic pain when you have pain that lasts greater than 3 months, and it's usually associated with substantial restrictions in life activities, including work, social issues, and self-care. The incidence of chronic pain is quite high. It's estimated that 50 million Americans in the United States experience chronic pain. So if you think in terms of cases per 1,000 person years, that's about 52 cases per 1,000 person years. Compare that with other chronic problems such as diabetes, 7 cases, depression, 16 cases per 1,000, hypertension, 45 cases per 1,000. It's estimated that billions and billions of dollars is lost in wages because of restrictions related to pain in people with chronic pain. So with that information, I'd like to talk to our guests about chronic pain and management of it. And so Brian's involved in integrative care. Can you tell us a little bit about your approach and what you are used to seeing and how you help folks?
Sure. Very good description of chronic pain. We're actually starting to call it persistent pain these days. I don't know why, but that probably came into being a couple of years ago. But we see patients primarily as a chiropractor with musculoskeletal problems. That's what walks in the office. That's what we see. That's what's referred to us. But musculoskeletal problems create a huge burden of chronic pain. They're very difficult to manage. Our current pain management system medically is basically an injection medication, a little bit of psychology, but very little. And chronic pain is a biopsychosocial phenomenon. So when we see patients come in with persistent pain, we're not only looking at what's the physical manifestation, what happened, what was the beginning of this, and what caused this thing to persist. So we have a lot of tools that we use when a patient comes in, several different forms they complete, and they tell us about fear avoidance behavior, anxiety, catastrophization behaviors, things like that. Now, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so I don't treat those things directly, but the way I talk to them about their pain and their function really has a good deal to do with whether or not we persist those beliefs and feelings for that patient, or we can change those beliefs and feelings. They have this feeling that they're injured, they're damaged, they're frail, they can't do what they need to do. Their life has kind of disappeared from them. So our job is to encourage them, give them different abilities, new abilities, and that sort of thing as we go. We don't want to keep the biological phenomenon at the forefront with these patients. Like they'll come in and tell me, oh, I'm a herniated disc patient. And I said, how long have you had this herniated disc? Oh, I've had it for years and years. I said, and then we tell them about education that tells us that imaging for people without pain often shows herniated discs. And so we try to help them get through that. And then we try to steer them towards things they can do. We try to get them to think a little bit less about this pain, a little bit more about restoring function. So that's really what we're about, is quality of life and restoring function with patients.
Thank you for that description. So I want to get a little bit more into the pain science, which I know you know a lot about. So we have acute pain, and then, as you said, persistent or chronic pain. And physiologically, they're different, aren't they?
Absolutely. So the pain system is there as a warning. So if you stub your toe or put your finger in the fire, your pain system sends you an alert that says, you know, take care of your body, do something about this. And so that's a good thing. There's a few people in the world that don't produce enough pain information and they get hurt at an early age. It can be catastrophic and fatal. And there's other people that produce too much of this pain sensation when they're injured. So the system of pain is very similar to any other system in your body. It's there to protect you and detect things. And it's basically your nervous system and your brain. What happens when this acute pain becomes persistent is that the input continues. So the hypersensitive nerves maintain at a heightened state, and it's more easy to trigger them. And then it becomes chronic as the brain changes. We have plastic changes in the brain. We have plastic changes in the spinal cord, where areas related to the development or manifestation of this painful output continue and are enhanced. We have a chemical system. There's two chemical systems in here for acute pain. We have a pain enhancing system. That means cholecystokinin is produced, and that is a facilitator. So that chemical facilitates increased pain sensation. So when you're acutely injured, you are going to have a lot more pain because your body wants to make sure that you protect it and don't keep injuring the area or aggravating the area. So you bandage it, wear a boot, protect it, and so forth, rest it, and so forth. When the pain becomes more persistent, what happens is that system fails to settle down, and we fail to bring about our descending inhibition, which are our natural opioids, cannabinoids, enkephalons, chemicals like that, that actually suppress the pain. So we have this tremendous chemical imbalance going on. And there's many, many things that cause that problem. So it's typically your acute pain is supposed to be a short-lived response, but when we have this imbalance between descending inhibition and descending facilitation, then we start to develop this chronic pain situation over time. And then this becomes an emotional thing, a psychological thing, and it really takes it out of the biological realm in many cases.
That's really good information. And I think from a standpoint of practicing physician, people come in with acute pain, and that's actually much more manageable when it's acute, because we have a whole variety of different things that we can use. We can use nonsteroidals, we can use acetaminophen or Tylenol, we can escalate it, and we can start using some degree of opiates that affect those acute pain receptors. And I think the big message that I think many of us have learned, not only physicians, but dentists, is to minimize the use of opiates, because beyond a certain point, that's helpful for acute pain, not so much for chronic pain. What percentage of people that have chronic or persistent pain do you think also have a comorbidity with depression?
Very high. Anxiety and depression are probably the top two drivers. To backtrack on your opiate conversation, there's actually opiate-induced hypersensitivity.
Yes.
So the receptors wear out, and so it takes more and more opiates, and it's still the pain becomes more and more intense. So it's really a big loss situation there with the opiates. Yeah, dentists initially, I mean, I remember when my kids had their wisdom teeth out, they got 20 Percocets.
Right.
You know, not happening anymore. The dentists actually had a study that showed that combination of Tylenol and ibuprofen was more powerful than many of the opiates. And that study just never really saw the light of day for a lot of years for a variety of reasons I don't want to go into. Now that's really the go-to. Yes. For a lot of dentists for post-procedural dental pain.
And I'm sure give a lot of kudos to the American Dental Association.
Absolutely. They published, they were the forefront of describing Wall and Melzack's model of pain, gait theory, and using the wind-up and the psychosocial work. They were really ahead of the game big time.
And I think it's because it was stunning until probably 10, 15 years ago, how many people developed narcotic dependence, which it was initiated through dental surgery.
Absolutely.
And they've done a great job in educating their practitioners to, you know, rarely, if ever, use narcotics for these painful conditions that are associated with dental surgery. That was a good learning lesson, I think, for physicians as well. We have to be very, very careful when we prescribe, and we're more careful now than ever when we prescribe narcotics.
Yeah, the opiate prescription levels are going way down, but unfortunately, the narcotic deaths are still going up.
Yeah.
In this country. That's a whole nother one. I had a patient a few weeks ago came in and he had anterior thigh pain. He was a military injury and he was on OxyContin, not a huge dose, but his primary doctor who retired, the new doctor said, I'm not going to prescribe that anymore. And this guy told me in the office, he said, I have to have this. I'm going to the street. You know, so that was a conversation with his primary care doc right there, but that was not a good scene. So when patients see the physician for the acute pain, like you said, that's simpler to manage, but there's other subtle things that are going on in that encounter that you can really change the course or help the course with those acute patients. First thing is to reassure them that there isn't anything serious or dangerous or terrible going on once you've done the medical evaluation that tells us that. We all look for red flags, right, of serious disease. But we want to reassure the patients that. We want to reassure them that pain will typically settle down. We want to encourage activity. We no longer want to encourage excessive rest or excessive bed rest because motion is lotion. Movement keeps things going. It keeps the patient feeling confident about their recovery. And we don't want to scare them with imaging or exam results and tell them that they have the spine of a 99-year-old because of the degeneration on there, or that, oh my gosh, you have multiple disc herniations. You're probably going to need surgery at some point. I've had so many patients. Most recent one is working with our friend Daryl over at CA in the boot camp. And he came to me with knee pain. And he said, my primary doctor said that I'll never be able to run again because I'm going to wear out my knee, because he had this little bit of knee pain climbing stairs. And I said, do you really believe that? He said, no. I said, so let's work on this. So I worked with him and got him into some graded exposure. And he continued with Daryl, and he's running 5Ks now. And the literature tells us that runners have no more issues with meniscus problems or degenerative disease in their knees than people that don't run, maybe less. Same with disc problems. People that are active and run have more elastic, more resilient discs in their back than people that are sedentary.
Mm-hmm.
So the information we deliver on some of those first few critical visits can tip the scales in favor of someone developing a chronic pain versus someone who's going to recover nicely and go about their business and be their own self-managing being.
Good information. Let's circle back to that notion about anxiety and depression. So many of patients who have been suffering with chronic pain feel hopeless and isolated, and nobody understands.
The social isolation, it's interesting, actually magnifies their focus on their pain. So that actually feeds their catastrophization. So we need to encourage them with all the wonderful opportunities that are available through CA and through our county for people to be active and interactive, like this weekend's walk with a doc. What a great opportunity to get out, get a little bit of education and go for a walk and ask questions along the way in a safe and encouraging social environment. Wonderful for people. Anxiety produces a lot of cortisol. Okay, so we constantly drip this cortisol at a low level with the anxious patient. And that shuts down their GABA production, okay, which is one of their inhibitory neurotransmitters. So it stops that to a trickle. And so it just allows those nasty nociceptive signals, pain information signals, to just flood through. And then that's going to eventually start to change brain plasticity. And it's going to cause them to be less mobile, less active, which all those things feed into this downward spiral, into this chronic pain and disuse and fear avoidance that they have.
Now, that's great that you mentioned about cortisol and catechols and how that affects our neurotransmitters like GABA. That's wonderful information. And it puts it in perspective for people who are suffering so much. And it really is, from the standpoint of the practitioner, being a standby coach to try and get people to gravitate towards pleasurable distractions is so important. Getting back into the flow of life is so important for people with chronic pain.
That is an absolute fact, Harry.
Yeah. Some of your chronic pain people, I'm sure, suffer from fibromyalgia.
Oh, yeah.
Is the approach any different?
Not too much. I don't know, you know, from reading about fibromyalgia, there's been so many different thoughts on it and whether it's purely psychological phenomenon or neurological phenomenon, or is it small fiber nerve disease? We're just not completely sure on that whole thing. But that's the approach I use. I think of them as that group of people who are just born with an overly sensitive nervous system in the beginning, and then some sort of insult kind of tips them over the edge. Probably not as dramatic as a complex regional pain syndrome person. We used to call it reflex sympathetic dystrophy, but still, it's certainly an overreaction to almost any kind of touch, so that we're light touch and things that shouldn't hurt at all would create a tremendous amount of pain for these patients. And if you look at, you know, the literature over time, one of the best management tools for the fibromyalgia patient is activity.
Fibromyalgia is a very interesting medical phenomenon. You know, when I was in medical school, we used to call it fibrositis, is what we call it. And the conventional thought at that time was it was more of a psychological disease than it was a physiologic disease. But I can tell you, having been in practice now for over three decades, that fibromyalgia is a real phenomenon, and there are probably multiple subsets. And part of it probably has to do with the immune system, as you mentioned.
Absolutely.
There are triggers that push people into fibromyalgia. When I talk to my patients about it, it's sort of like the princess and the pea. You know, the princess was on 20 mattresses, but she could still feel the pea. Mm-hmm. And there are people that are super sensitive. And what that's all about and what drives that is an enigma. But also, to your point, I think what you're saying is your approach to chronic pain, persistent pain, is very multi-pronged, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is.
Tell us a little bit about the therapies that you employ.
So we use a lot of rehabilitative exercise because we find that's the best way to find what people can do and start there, encourage them through and give them hope, improve some capacity in some part of their life. Being in rehab is a little bit social. We use manual therapy, and we don't use it as I'm going to fix this misalignment, or I'm going to stretch this muscle, or I'm going to beat this fascia into submission or whatever. I don't think any of that's actually a real outcome of most manual therapy, to be honest with you. But it's a great opportunity to kind of engage the patient in focusing on their tissues and what their tissues are doing, tissue consistency, what movement is lacking, what movement could be improved. It helps steer them into, okay, we're going to use rehab to work on this area that's not working or moving as well as it should. We're going to coach them on an anti-inflammatory diet. We're going to steer them towards a more plant-based type of diet. We're going to explore their willingness to exercise and do self-care. We are going to steer them to different apps that will help them do mindfulness meditation type of things. So I like Jon Kabat-Zinn, but there's a million other places to go with that. We work with cognitive behavioral therapists to help them with that. I don't do cognitive behavioral therapy, although some of the rehab you do could be termed cognitive functional therapy. That's another topic for another time. But simply that package of that, and I'm not a nutritionist, I'm not a GI doctor, but I think, like you said, gut health is really important. So if their physician is interested and wants to do a workup on, you know, their microbiome, that would be wonderful. I think there's some docs around here like Dr. Rao who will check on the microbiome on patients. I think that can be really important because let's face it, your nervous system and your immune system are ultimately all tied up in your gut. There's a great book called The Second Brain that talks about your nervous system and your gut and how that communicates through the immune system. So all those things are really, really important. So that's kind of our approach with our persistent pain patients, or if patients that we feel are heading in that direction. You also want to intervene if you start to see flags that tell you this person has a propensity or a tendency. Let's deal with this now.
Those are all good points. I think, and you mentioned about the microbiome, which I think is important for health. Even if you're not having pain, it's important.
Exactly.
Promote a healthy microbiome, which can be done by, you know, having a non-inflammatory diet, because basically most disease is about inflammation at some level.
You bet.
So I think all those things are important. There may be a role for supplements. You may encourage, you know, certain supplements being used We talk a lot about curcumin as a great anti-inflammatory.
Can I ask you a question while we're on to curcumin for a sec? Because I know you know about this. So typically that we've been told that having the black pepper in the curcumin aids absorption, but now I'm seeing some studies that are telling me that the black pepper can actually increase gut permeability and drive leaky gut. Have you run into that yet?
I haven't seen that. There's not a lot of black pepper in it. The studies do show us that if you take curcumin with black pepper, bioperine, that it will raise curcumin levels.
Right.
But not everybody's taking curcumin. Some people are just using the whole herb, a turmeric, which I have no problem with. I have a number of people that put a little small amount of turmeric in whatever they're eating on a daily basis, and that probably is helpful. And it's very interesting about turmeric. One thing that I came across a while back was, if you look at the lowest Alzheimer rate in the world, it's in India where they have the greatest consumption of turmeric.
That's a good reason right there. Do you use a Boswellia or borage oil with your patients?
I don't, but I certainly have seen the citations that it could be helpful.
Yeah, we tend to steer them towards those kinds of things.
So let's see. We've talked about depression and anxiety. We've talked about fibromyalgia. Oh, I did want to ask you one other thing, and then we'll wrap it up. Hot and cold therapy. Your thoughts?
Okay. So it used to be ice all the time. Remember rice? So do you know who developed rice?
No.
Gabe Merkin. He's a he's a talk show host, and he was a podiatrist down in, I guess it was Bethesda. I think he's still there. And several years later, he came out with an "Oops, I made a boo-boo" article. And so he said, well, ice causes decreased blood flow, so we really want to maybe not use that very long after the initial injury. Compression causes decreased blood flow, so we actually want to get rid of the compression and allow the blood flow into that area. Elevation is still good, and rest to avoid injury is still good. So he came up with a new acronym called METH, which is mobilization, elevation, traction, and heat. And a friend of mine's a chiropractor in the NFL, and he says the NFL is actually getting quite away from ice therapy in a lot of injury cases and going to heat applications right away. So in our office, we kind of let the patients choose after the first 24 hours. If it's an acute, you know, sprain and I'm seeing swelling and the usual accompanying changes with that, I'm going to say, let's ice for a day. It's not going to hurt you. Let's just rest it. I hardly use braces at all in my clinic. People don't walk out of here with a back brace. We don't brace people up. If somebody's knee is unstable enough, they need a brace, I'm sending them over to orthopedics for that person, you know?
Right. So the hot and cold therapy also. So I see cold therapy, you know, sometimes for acute injuries to manage the pain.
Yep.
But to your point, what you're really doing is you're limiting the ability of migration of some of the inflammatory cells, which are helpful in actually healing.
So yeah, they communicate to the rest of the system, says bring in the repair guys.
Yeah. But there may be a role in the future for some cryotherapy interventions. You may be aware of this.
So the Wim Hof, that's a whole different animal. Yeah. I haven't studied that too much.
The cryotube is a very interesting entity that's getting some attention. And in a cryotube, you're actually entering a tube for about 3 minutes and being exposed to a super, super low temperature. And the outcome actually is that when you're out of the tube for hours and maybe several days later, your metabolism has changed a little bit. But the other thing is there's a massive release of endorphins, which seems to help. So that's the cold therapy cryotube.
Are you using that for more for a wellness thing or a?
It's more of a wellness thing, but I do know of many fibromyalgia patients who have investigated that, and there's one or two available in the area. Mm-hmm. As far as heat therapy goes, I'm a big proponent of sauna therapy.
Dry sauna
or steam, elevating your body temperature, causing hormesis and the potentiation of certain healing pathways can be very, very helpful. And we've actually done a whole Finding Your Wellness on sauna therapy, both for, you know, treatment of certain painful conditions, as well as just improving health. So I think these modalities, you know, can be helpful. And I think there's a whole variety of science, which is kind of leading the way and telling us about sauna therapy, cryotherapy, and now you may know about photomodulation, the use of red light. So all of these things are up and coming. And I think can be part of the toolkit that you use, that I use to get people well, whether we're talking about chronic pain or inflammatory conditions.
I think that's great. The take home I have on all the interventions that are new, I mean, nobody but my profession has been accused of being early adopters of unproven technology, okay?
Yeah.
Some of the stuff sticks and some of it doesn't. But sometimes, and I don't know about cryotherapy or the saunas, but some of these external things like ultrasound and laser and different things lead the patient to the belief that they still are broken and need an external fix. So I'm really interested in getting the locus of control with the patient, giving them the self-efficacy that they're in charge. We kind of think of ourselves as the guide by the side, like you talked about, like Alfred is to Batman with our patients. And that's kind of how we want to approach it. I'm sure all these other modalities are helpful, but I think they need to be, the context needs to be clearly explained.
I agree. Well, this has been a terrific discussion. Thank you so much for being our guest on this podcast. And thanks to our audience for listening. And thank you to the Columbia Association for sponsoring Finding Your Wellness. You can listen to all of our podcasts from Finding Your Wellness by typing into your browser podbean.com/Dragon Podcasts. This is Dr. Harry Okin for Finding Your Wellness.